Am I turned on? Okay. Yeah, I'm still kind of, I don't really feel the best. And like I said last week, I like being able to see the slides up here. And so that's what I'm going to do if it's not too informal. Yeah. Hopefully that'll work out. So I have a radical departure from last week. I decided to do a topical sermon, so we'll see how that goes. By the way, Matt and Robin, welcome into membership. That's exciting. That's great. we wrapped up our home group sort of on C.S. Lewis this last week, although we're going to have a dinner this week. And we had some, I think it was a profitable time. I think it was really good. We had really good conversation, I thought. We also had some candid moments, like when one member of our group said this past week, I don't want to love my enemy. I want to leave them in a pool of their own blood. And I don't think this was a confession. I think this was just a statement they were making. So I'm not going to lead a home group again. That's my plan. And that person shall remain anonymous. So I'm titling the sermon this morning, The Head and the Heart. And this is a topic that's always been of interest to me. And it might be better put the head, we got problems here. The head versus the heart. A lot of times that's sort of the way people tend to put it. And these are sort of the go-to phrases people use when referring to sort of the disparity that seems to show up between our intellect and our heart or our emotions. So you have rational thoughts set against our feelings and emotions, and this is usually presented as some sort of dichotomy. It's one or the other. Should I listen to my head or should I listen to my heart? And the head is sort of portrayed as being interested in safety, self-interest. It's logical. It's sort of the cold, calculating voice of reason. And the heart is this wellspring of good and potentially evil. And they're all constantly fighting against each other all the time, one to be heard over the other. And everyone has their own view on this. I think some would insist that evil probably comes from closing off the heart and letting your intellect run things alone, while others would tend to see it sort of the opposite way, where the heart is really what's corrupt and unreliable, and the mind serves to keep from us veering too far off course over the cliff, if you will. So our most frequent exposure to this idea is when we have to do decision-making and how this tends to play out psychologically. This is from Psychology Today. And they said, suppose you're torn between two options, one risky and the other safe. The risky option lures you into making a quick online purchase. Let's just say shoes, for my wife's sake. Even though you know it's more than you can or should spend, but time is running out because there's only two pairs of shoes left. So you better hurry. Your heart is urging you, go for it, telling you how great you will look in them and how happy it will make you. Shouting no just as loudly as your head, which instructs you to take a pass, save your money, you don't need it anyway, and you have plenty of shoes. This conflict in the decision-making process then makes us uncomfortable. And the winner of the online purchase debate is whichever voice happens to be louder. And usually it's the voice that we are more naturally inclined towards because it's been better fed and it's stronger than the other voice. But human beings, at the same time, have free will, and they can choose to listen to the quieter, nagging voice that won't quite go away. A good example of this, we were just watching Murder on the Orient Express this week, and I won't give away the ending exactly, but it sort of has that sort of feel to it. And the split is all over our culture. The first example I thought of after this was politics. Republicans and Democrats, or you could just say conservatives and liberals, if that fits better, are often portrayed in this way, like the one they don't care about anybody, but they'll at least get us in under budget, and the liberals are supposedly the ones interested in social justice, but it's going to cost you an arm and a leg. But of course, those are gross characterizations that are really actually not very accurate. And who hasn't heard the comparison, do you believe in science or religion, right? This assumes some sort of facts versus faith sort of approach, right? Which ought to make us think, is this separation, whenever we're presented with one, conjured up, or is it a real separation? in the case of the shoes, you're going to buy them or you're not going to buy them. You're going to listen to one voice. Again, politics is a terrible example. I have no interest in talking about that this morning. But we should all know that the segregating science and religion, when understood properly, is just a category error. There's no natural or fundamental contradiction there. It would be like saying, do you want to learn how to count or do you want to live? And you have to pick between those two things. My first example, I'm terrible with analogies. My first analogy that came to mind was, what was it, do you want English muffins or a used car? So, I don't know. Terrible. So this would be a false dichotomy, or what we'd call a false dilemma. And people fall prey to these all the time if they're not thinking about things in the right way. And perhaps they're just parroting things that they've heard. That seems to be what usually happens. One could argue in our Western culture that rationality and our brain's cognitive abilities are actually highly valued. Students are judged all the time and based on cognitive intelligence. We desire and foster the brain's executive functions like rational analysis, planning, problem solving. And as I was alluding to, some people are just more comfortable with following their heads. It's clear-cut, it's safer, it's objective, and it's quantifiable, which is a great word, very comforting word. But then many would be quick to say, yes, while that may be true of segments of our culture, the church really is more of an enterprise of the heart than the mind, which actually leads us to the direction I want to go to this morning. Is belief in Christianity a matter of the head or the heart, the belief part, or is this actually just serving to be another false dilemma? So there's a good bit of history, some of it church history and philosophy. Almost all of it is exclusively Christian philosophy that we'll be spending most of our time on this morning. And if this is something you have thought about, you can be sure you will run into plenty of people that have not thought about this or have not thought very deeply about this. So certainly this would be sort of a subset tool of some evangelism and hopefully thought-provoking for us as well, though hopefully not merely intellectually. One home group I've been considering is a book called Making Sense of It All, and it kind of goes over some of one of the figures we'll talk about this morning, Blaise Pascal, some of his theories and ideas, all of which we would not necessarily agree with, but he has some amazing insights. And so if you hate this, that'll just be good to know ahead of time, I suppose. Not long ago, I had sort of what amounted to the start of a conversation with Chad Strong, where he brought up René Descartes and rationalism, and I suggested that he looked at some of Pascal's writings and sort of a foil for his position of rationality. Both men, Pascal and Descartes, who we will talk about, that's Descartes and that's Pascal, they're going to come up a lot here, sort of epitomize at their time the differences between the head and the heart approach. At first, this is actually fairly surprising, since both of these men were not just significant figures in philosophy, but in mathematics and science, and they were just consummate, rigorous thinkers, and they weren't just brilliant, but they accomplished groundbreaking work. They came up with original ways to explain things that had never been done before, and not just in science, but in life and belief in God. Probably their two most famous quotes are, "I think, therefore I am." You can figure out who's who here. And the heart has its reasons, which reason knows nothing of. So that would be Descartes and Pascal, sort of in a nutshell. I think a lot of what we see in Pascal with his emphasis on the heart is actually best viewed in light, or perhaps in reaction to Descartes' writings on philosophy of reasoning or rationality. And, of course, every philosopher is inevitably shaped in some way by those that come before them. And then this was the time just leading up to and really just launching the Enlightenment in Europe. So I'm going to just give you a super extraordinary, perhaps irresponsible brief history of what sort of would have influenced these men, because I think it's actually important to know. So if we go back to a few hundred years BC, we're probably all familiar with Socrates. He's the guy that went around and asked lots of questions and got killed for it because they did not like that very much. So he, of course, originated the Socratic method. But he had his followers and his fans, and you may remember Plato as sort of his star pupil. And he gets brought up a lot here for his Platonic ideas that actually still seem to influence the Christian church, not all for the good. And his protege was Aristotle, who is arguably the most influential of the three, and his theories largely actually stayed intact up till the time of Descartes and Pascal, and in some ways still today. What's so interesting about these three is that they all held very different views. What we tend to see is, you know, if a student studies under a master, he sort of becomes a carbon copy of that guy, but you know, the very nature of philosophy is to think for yourself and come up with new answers. So it's probably fitting that they would each develop their own philosophy for themselves. So, for example, Plato had the theory of forms that would say about a circle. No one can draw, and this is true, no one can draw or has ever seen a absolutely perfect circle, but the abstract concept of the perfect circle, he would call that the reality and the perfect form of, and the concrete objects in the circles we draw, these are but a mere shadow, and by their nature, they are inferior and defective. But Aristotle took nearly the opposite view. He said, we find out what a true circle is by looking at lots and lots of circles. And this is where we get our truth about the form, and he has sort of a bottom-up approach instead of a top-down approach. And so the shift in thinking is enormous, and actually went on for some time, as I said. So in his day, Aristotle sent out lots of people to collect information about all over the world, and he wrote up theories explaining the nature of all kinds of things in the world. And what he comes up with is so highly thought of and relied upon that rather than spurring people on to make their own inquiries, people tended to take his work on authority, like the Bible, because he said it, which is ironic because that certainly was not his goal. So now we'll fast forward all the way to the 1500s, or I'm sorry, the 1200s, this would be Francis Bacon, and he formalized the actual scientific method that we still use today. He did this in an effort to replace what had become the traditional Aristotelian science, and he didn't want to be taking things on authority anymore. He wanted to test them. He said that scientific inquiry would, quote, assure man's mastery over the world, end quote. Interestingly, though, he believed that science could progress, but he never gave any explicit examples. It was more like a theory that he had, which is amazing to us today. So the timeline here, I think, would be helpful. In the 1500s, I was right the first time, sorry. So we have Sir Francis Bacon. I was going to make some comments on Aquinas from the 1200s, and my sermon was getting too long, and then I confused myself, sorry. So we have Francis Bacon. In the 1500s, Galileo, shortly after, was born. Descartes, almost at the turn of the century, and then Blaise Pascal. So at one point, all of these men were alive. And I actually, until studying this, I always thought Galileo was like hundreds of years before them, but here he is. I was probably confusing him with Copernicus. I don't know. Anyway, a great example of the traditional Aristotelian system was... and it's the push in modernism away from it was gravity. Aristotle claimed that if you had a wood block and a metal block of the same size at the same height, the metal block would have to fall faster because it was heavier. And nobody tested this for 1,800 years. So until Galileo came along, and he implemented the scientific method that Bacon had developed, and he found out it was false. It's crazy. Like, who does that? So, I don't know. It's amazing. So, obviously, some changes were in order. They didn't want to always be taking things on authority. But, of course, what came along with that is they didn't necessarily take anything on authority. So, they, along with others, worked to usher in the modern era. The modernist movement was all about questioning things, whether it be science or the church. So now people didn't know things because God had revealed them, but people knew things because they were able to discover truth. So this was a shift, again, away from authority, which is significant. Modernism assumes an objective reality whose existence and properties are logically independent of human beings. Now you can compare this to the postmodern era that we now live in. Postmodernism dismisses modernism as a naive realism and is instead characterized by this broad skepticism, of course, relativism, and a general suspicion of reason, and it's replaced with an elevation in ideology. This means there are ultimately no answers in our day and age when it comes to certain categories of truth, perhaps not math. Many people will believe in scientific or mathematical truth, but when you try to talk about existential things, I'm sure you've had this experience, like love or faith, those are considered to be subjective, and then therefore you have nothing to say. So in summary, you have the pre-modern movement appeal to authority, and this included not just church, but science, which is weird. So they changed the whole ball of wax in modernism, used reason and science with the goal to arrive at definitive answers. And so those that wanted to stay pre-modernist, of course, wanted to pull their hair out. So Descartes would fit nicely into modernism. Sorry about that. Postmodernism, which is where we are now, says there's no truth, there's no one answer, and those that remain modernists will again want to pull their hair out. And it could be argued that Pascal actually has a little bit of all of these in him, which is pretty interesting. So we'll start with this guy. If Socrates, if you can see that, this is René Descartes. René is a guy's name, apparently. If Socrates, you think of him as the father of philosophy, Descartes is the father of modern philosophy. He was a renowned French mathematician and scientist, and he was born, as I said, just before the turn of the 17th century to a noble Roman Catholic family. He was a puny and weak child. He wasn't even expected to live, but he actually did, and he actually received the finest formal education possible, including the Jesuit College at La Flèche, where Aristotle was taught out of scholastic commentary, so he was very familiar with Aristotle. He then went on to get a law degree, and his father probably expected him to enter Parliament, but at this point, he was only 20, so he wasn't able to do that. So he was a little bright. With a strong academic foundation, he actually spent about 9 years traveling Europe, studying what he called the Book of the World, which sounds really fun. This is hilarious. So while in Bohemia, he invented analytic geometry. It's like, I don't know, it just cracks me up. Anyway, yeah, I'll come up with something like that. And he also devised the universal method of deductive reasoning based on mathematics that was applicable to all different sciences. So, for example, in one of his later essays, he derived the law of refraction using this method to explain the rainbow. So he had obviously a prodigious mind. Most high school students would know him by his contribution of the two-dimensional rectangular coordinate system. That's why we call it the Cartesian coordinate system. And the breakthrough here wasn't graphing, but that he connected numbers and equations with the graphs that had never been done before. And this is actually what made calculus possible. It just didn't get to us till Newton and Leibniz came along. In his early work on physics, he held the heliocentric view that Galileo held. But since Galileo was under the Roman Inquisition, he decided not to talk about that so much. And he actually moved to the Netherlands at one point. But when Descartes moved to Paris, he sort of was in society. He gambled, rode, he did fencing, he went to court, the theater, and he was a very well-versed person. Among his friends, and this guy's important, was Father Marin Marcin, who was also kind of a mathematician. He was a universal sort of learner who corresponded with hundreds of scholars, including Galileo and Descartes. And so he finally got in touch with this larger intellectual world, you know, because back then you can publish things maybe, but who's going to do it? And there's no internet. So, you know, like if you're in Italy, like Aquinas, what was he in Italy? And Magnus was in Germany. And so they're doing kind of the same thing, but how the heck are they going to know? They're in completely different countries. So that network was key to actually making the Enlightenment happen. Descartes was not exactly a Catholic enthusiast, sort of a Catholic in name only, and he advocated for religious tolerance, and his main goal was always to champion the use of reason. At 40, his big work was The Discourse on Method, and it was very interesting because it was the first modern philosophical work that wasn't written in Latin. Descartes said he wrote it in French so that all that had good sense, including women, his words, not mine, could read his work and learn to think for themselves. Of course, he knew Latin. He believed that everyone could tell truth from false by the light of reason alone. In this work, he also illustrated his conception of knowledge. It kind of makes this tree. Grounded in metaphysics, those would be the spiritual realities corresponding to the roots of the tree, going up to physics in the trunk, and then branching out to medicine, mechanics, morals. These are all the branches. But the question is, how did Descartes establish a spiritual or metaphysical foundation? He was a very skeptical man. Well, Descartes believed that our senses, or sensory perception, are untrustworthy, as Plato also thought, because such experience is actually sometimes misleading. For example, he notes that he often dreams about things that aren't even real and don't exist, and so therefore he has no way of knowing with any certainty whether he's dreaming or awake. Even seemingly apparent knowledge of simple truth, like, for example, 2 plus 3 equals 5, because there could be a demon causing him to think it's true when, in fact, 2 plus 3 is 6, he doesn't even believe that can be known. So how did he get anywhere, right? It doesn't seem possible that he can entertain any sort of belief. But this is when he arrives at this conclusion. He finds certainty in the intuition that when he's thinking, even if he's being deceived, he has to exist, which is, of course, true. And so that's sort of the background behind this saying. It's a lot more loaded than it probably seems to be at first. And from this one phrase, he actually derived the rest of his philosophy, including the existence of God. He made an argument using what's actually called, I think he called it the causal adequacy principle, which basically he's just taking an ontological argument that Anselm had developed about 400 years prior, saying basically if I have the thought of God in my head, there sort of has to be a God, or why would the thought even be there? And he made it just a tiny bit more elaborate, but that was at the heart of his rationalism, and that was satisfactory for him. And it actually sounds a lot like William Lane Craig talks about Leibniz's contingency argument a lot, which is much more full of syllogisms and logical and therefore a little more airtight. But again, Descartes didn't really care for Aristotle and kind of wanted to phrase things in his own way. So it's a little bit of a klutzy argument, but it kind of worked for him. So this is interesting because it also implies that knowledge of God's existence is required for any certainty of knowledge. So in his view, atheists who are ignorant of God's existence can't know anything about science, which is an interesting conclusion. Free will, according to Descartes, is the sign of God in human nature, and human beings can be praised or blamed according to their use for it. People are good, he believed, only to the extent that they act freely for the good of others. Such generosity, he thought, was the highest virtue. Descartes would be what we would call Epicurean in his assertion that human passions are good in of themselves. So this is an interesting view he had. He was an extreme moral optimist in his belief that the understanding of the good is automatically followed by a desire to do good, which is obviously not something we would agree with. Even during Descartes' lifetime, there were questions about whether he was concerned with actually supporting Christian doctrine, or he was just an atheist concerned with protecting himself from the church, and he was really only concerned about physics and philosophy. This actually appears to be a little difficult to answer because many papers have been lost, but the Roman Catholic Church, upon his death, put his books in the Index of Prohibited Books, so they made up their mind. The Protestant ministers he interacted with in the Netherlands called him a Jesuit and a papist, which was their way of saying he was an atheist. Up till a certain time, there was some belief that maybe he was actually interested in religious issues, but up till recently, most commentators have come to believe that Descartes was a Catholic in the same way he was a Frenchman, which is to say, by name only. Descartes himself said that good sense is destroyed when one thinks too much of God. He once told a German protege of his, Anna Maria von Schurmann, that she was wasting her intellect studying Hebrew and theology. So, in contrast, Blaise Pascal, he was also French. He was a mathematician and physicist, a philosopher, but more of a religious philosopher, and he was a master of prose. That was one thing that was different between them. He was born, like I said, a little bit later in 1623, so he would have been 29 when he was born, so they're definitely contemporaries. Pascal's mother died when he was 3. His father took on the schooling of the children. That was very important to him. And in fact, he was actually homeschooled, which is what it amounts to. So he wasn't actually exposed to Aristotle, and he had a completely different background, therefore, than Descartes did. So he actually learned to think for himself. His father believed that math ought to come after Pascal had mastered languages, so the math texts were actually locked up and forbidden. And it said, without access to these texts, it is said that by 10 or 11, he independently reconstructed Euclid's elements, which is, I don't know if you know what that is, but that's crazy. When his father saw his prodigious ability, he was actually ecstatic, and all the books came out, and his education really began at that point. His father was a respected mathematician himself, and he ran in these very intellectual circles, and so Pascal was able to be exposed to the great minds of the time, and just, I'm sure, listen in on amazing conversations. At 17, Blaise wrote a still famous essay on conic sections. His work was successful in the world of mathematics, and it aroused even the envy of none other than Descartes. So I like this quote about both of them. For some reason, I ran across this quote, and I thought it's so insulting, but really clever. You know, like, yeah, your children are special, but some children are really special. So he was very special. It's hilarious. As I mentioned, Father Mersenne was at the hub of the international intellectual activity. So Descartes submitting paper, Galileo submitting papers, and he's actually tutoring Pascal by the age of 13. So it is obviously very exciting. At 19, Pascal constructed the first ever calculating device called the Pascaline to help his father because he was a tax administrator and he had obviously lots of number crunching to do. Pascal was also the first to design and implement a public transportation system, you know, like... just did that too. And interesting, Pascal was proud of his accomplishments, so shall we say. But at the same time, he was actually embarrassed by them and the abundance of his talents. So in many ways, as you'll see, he was sort of a conflicted person. Up until now, the Pascal family, like Descartes, was a Roman Catholic family held to the principles, but a family physician had introduced them to the theological concept of Jansenism. So where if Descartes was anything, he might have been a Jesuit. We have Jansenism, which is completely different. It was a 17th century form of Augustinianism in the Roman Catholic Church. It rejected free will, accepted predestination, and taught that divine grace was the only key to salvation. This is when Blaise began to feel even more conflicted. He wanted to turn away from the world. And to him, worldliness was studying math and science. Okay. Which is fair, but not probably how we would think of that, and then turn instead toward God. Jansenism began upon the death of Cornelius Jansen and was based on his views, like I said, of Augustine's work. In his view, he believed in the fundamental depravity of man and salvation was clearly only in God's choosing. So, I think basically Calvinism. The Jesuits, who believed in prevenient grace, did not like this because it was what the Protestants were teaching. Therefore, they were often seen as heretics. Yet, Pascal would try to absorb himself occasionally in scientific interests. He tested the theories of Galileo and Torricelli, who discovered the principle of the barometer. So while experimenting in this field, Pascal also invented the syringe, the hydraulic press, and other things. Then his next distraction is just very interesting, and it's worth mentioning, because he basically was trying to solve the problem of the vacuum. And the vacuum is a little like, you know, the heliocentric model was opposed by the church because they thought it opposed Scripture. Well, the idea of a vacuum would be a space entirely devoid of matter. This was a controversial idea at the time, very. So this would be, you know, your typical incandescent light bulb. Space is a vacuum. Creating a vacuum is basically a middle school science project nowadays. But at the time, like Aristotle and Descartes believed there must be something everywhere, including space, and it was believed the ramifications were if God is everywhere and a vacuum is empty, a vacuum would mean God would not be there, and therefore there can be no such thing as a vacuum. Which is interesting. Galileo actually did agree with Pascal's conclusion that the vacuum ought to work. The question was, upon creating it, how do you know there's nothing in there? And it's very interesting. He even did this publicity stunt, not just with mercury, but with this huge vat of wine, and was using barometric pressure, creating a vacuum on top. And anyway, he was a little bit of a showy guy. Anyway, very interesting. One last mathematical accomplishment that's relevant to our conversation and his religious work is that he laid the foundation of probability theory also in his spare time by working with Pierre Fermat on what's called the gambling problem, which I don't have time to explain. It doesn't mean like you have a gambling problem. The gambling problem has to do with dividing up the winnings if somebody leaves a game early, and very interesting stuff. So This is where Pascal developed the idea of the expected value. And expected value is a huge deal in mathematics. It's a critical component to what is known as Pascal's wager, which I'll get to in a minute. So around 30, he began to feel his religious scruples again and experienced what is called his night of fire. It's an intense and seemingly mystical conversion that was the beginning of a new life for him. Pascal wrote it down on a piece of parchment and actually sewed it into the lining of his coat, and it was only found after his death. And this is what he wrote. Year of Grace, 1654, Monday 23, November, Feast of St. Clement. From about 10:30 to about half an hour after midnight, fire. God of Abraham, God of Isaac, God of Jacob, not of philosophers and scholars. Certitude, heartfelt joy, peace. God of Jesus Christ, God of Jesus Christ, my God and your God. Joy, 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 tears of joy. Jesus Christ, may I never be separated from him. He never again published under his own name and chiefly developed his famous work that are called the Provincial Letters and the Pensées. One was for the sake of the church and the other was intended to be a Christian apologetic. The Provincial Letters were written and published over a period of time against the relaxed morality he saw among the Jesuits. The Catholic Church had been aggressively pursuing the Jansenists, and through these letters, Pascal was able to sort of ease the conflict. His success in this was not only due to his ability to think well, but he had this very, as I said, precise literary style. But what he wrote wasn't just rhetoric. Even in 1678, later, Pope Innocent XI himself condemned half the propositions that Pascal was also denouncing. So these letters ended up playing a decisive role in church history. They denounced the idea that one could atone for sin, continued sin, by frequent communion without repentance, and remained unchallenged until the Edict of Nantes, which had granted religious freedom to French Protestants at that time. Pascal aligned himself with those who believe that the ideal of evangelical perfection must be inseparable with that of the Christian life. Although there was nothing new to these ideas, Pascal stamped on them with a sort of passion and conviction of a man in love with the absolute, a man who saw no salvation apart from a heartfelt desire for the truth, together with the love for God that works continually toward destroying self-love, as he called it. Pascal finally decided to write, as I said, a work of Christian apologetics as a consequence of his meditations on miracles and other proofs in Christianity. But the work ended up remaining unfinished at his death, and then sometime later editors put it together as it was tied in different lumps with strings, and they just sort of published it that way under what is called the Pensées, which means thoughts. From the Pensées, we can derive basically two basic philosophies that he held. The first question was, how do we live in a world we can't fully understand? And his answer was, we have to make the best choices we can under conditions of uncertainty. This is what led to, again, his wager, which I'm almost to. The second question would be, how do we make sense of a life where we are so inadequate and ineffective? And his answer was, this can only be addressed by religion. According to Pascal, rational proofs alone won't promote true belief. So we have to look at the human condition, which is one of fracturedness, and we're unable to attain happiness, wisdom, true knowledge, apart from God. In an ironic twist, though, Pascal says our very consciousness of these things means that we can transcend them. In many ways, our lives are like those of animals, and unhappy animals at that, because we can actually imagine something better. So this is a problem, but it gives us hope at the same time. We're very much a part of the natural world, and on another level, we desire to transcend it. This leads Pascal to the conclusion that Christianity alone is the only thing that can answer this. We were once happy, but there was a fall, and now this is where we are. It's like we still have memories about real truth and justice and virtue, which sounds a lot like C.S. Lewis's argument for desire and longing in Surprised by Joy. We were just talking about that in group a little bit. In this way, he understands that we inherit original sin and guilt, which he believes ought to serve to compel others to inquiry rather than to hopelessness. Especially after reading the Pensées, a lot of people say that Pascal was a brutal pessimist. But what else would a non-Christian see in writings of a man who believed in depravity? right? We see in the Ponzi's the exact opposite of every popular self-help book that is out there right now. Strangely enough, many people end up being invigorated and less depressed after reading it. One of his quotes is, "How hollow and foul is the heart of man." And you can get the Ponzi's. It was not published in English originally, of course. But just getting a copy of the different sayings and reading over them, it's pretty fascinating. Another quote along these lines, "Man's greatness comes from knowing he is wretched." It's a great quote. At this time in his life, Pascal mingled among the aristocracy and saw his friends spending lots of time, this is not directed at you, playing billiards and lots of money on gambling. Gambling, by the way, that he had made more effective by his development of probability theory. So this actually led him to evangelism. He was actually convicted by sort of what he had done and wanted to serve to undo his work. First, billiards. He noticed the amount of time and energy men spent hitting a ball around with a stick, and this seemed enough to keep...
I know you have.
I'm so sorry. And this is enough to keep them distracted from any meaningful thinking for large periods of time. This supported his conclusion that men will do anything to keep from serious thinking and being alone with their thoughts. He called this the danger of diversion. One of his quotes, "A trifle consoles us because a trifle upsets us." And probably even better said, "Man's own happiness," that should not be on. "Man's own happiness comes from his inability to stay..." "Man's unhappiness," that's a typo, "man's unhappiness comes from his inability to stay peacefully alone in his own room." Another great concern of Pascal's was that of complete indifference, which a lot of his friends had, which we would call apathy. "The indifference of the skeptic," Pascal wrote, "is to be overcome by means of the wager. If God does not exist, the skeptic loses nothing by believing in him, but if he doesn't exist, the skeptic gains eternal life by believing in him." So, in a nutshell, this is Pascal's wager, and it has actually suffered a lot of misunderstanding of what it is trying to accomplish. His wager was not a proof for God, like the ontological or the moral argument or the cosmological arguments are. Pascal was simply taking the principle he had developed of expected value, which I do not have time to explain, that he had developed and gamblers came to rely on, and was simply showing them that if they believe this, they ought to apply it to even more important things. In essence, what he says is, even if the odds of believing in God or God existing is only 50-50, let's just say the odds are even, of course he didn't believe this, then it is still worth believing in God, since you have an infinite payoff of bliss in eternity, which is more sensible than the limited payoff of enjoying worldly pleasures for a brief time. And that certainly doesn't do it justice, but it is, again, addressed very well in this book. But the common objection that quickly comes to mind is, well, like believing in flying elephants, I may want to believe in something, but how can I make myself believe if all I believe in is the statistics? And he had an answer to this. He said, right action leads to right belief. He believed that God will honor the humble efforts of such a man and not deny him what he really wants. Pascal's apologetics, though it stood the test of time, was actually addressed to his individual acquaintances. He was trying to convert his libertine friends, like sort of Paul on Mars Hill, and he looked for arguments using their own favorite authors. For Pascal, skepticism, he saw that as just one stage that you ought to end up moving through. When he considered involving himself again in scientific work, he ended up basically becoming sick and again had these conflicted feelings of self-esteem, and he wrote what is called the Prayer for Conversion that the Wesley brothers ended up regarding very highly and using frequently. And often, and I've kind of glossed over this point, he was scarcely capable of regular work. He was very sickly. He was bedridden very often and had to be cared for. Toward the end of his life, he had more of an ascetic life and a devotional life, and he helped the poor, and he actually ended up dying at 39 years old, which is, yeah, amazing. For Pascal, belief cannot be justified by knowledge of God alone. The existence of God cannot be justified completely rationally. You have to believe, Pascal says, because it's absurd. For him, the truth is accessible by the heart foremost, and then the mind. So the premise was, is the belief in Christianity a matter of head, the head, or of the heart? Or perhaps is this more of a false dilemma? I think all we can really do is break down some of the individual arguments, because this is a very obviously a large topic, and treating it as a whole is kind of where modernism sort of got itself into trouble. They wanted to answer questions, and then people after 400 years of modernism became a little disillusioned and realized maybe we don't have all the answers after all. Descartes was skeptical of the senses, for example, so he relied totally on rational thought. Pascal saw the limitation in rational thought, and so he relied on the heart for spiritual matters. Therefore, where Descartes was interested in proving God, Pascal did not think that it could be done. And this seems to me, again, like a bit of a false dilemma. Proofs for God aren't proofs in the scientific sense, but that doesn't mean that we don't try to do them and convince other people or ourselves. Descartes' morality is anti-Jansenist and anti-Calvinist, you might say, in that he maintains that while grace is necessary for salvation, human beings can be virtuous and able to achieve salvation when they do their best to find and act upon the truth. His optimism on human reason contrasts with that of Pascal, who as a Jansenist, he appeared very pessimistic and who believed that salvation only comes as God's irresistible grace comes to you. And again, as a lot of us would hold, that seems to be a bit of a false dilemma going to the ends of the spectrum, although Pascal, of course, could be right. Descartes seems indifferent to the emotional depths of religion, whereas Pascal trembled when he looked into the infinite universe and perceived the puniness and the misery of man. Descartes exulted in the power of human reason to understand the cosmos and to promote happiness, and he rejected the view that human beings are essentially miserable and sinful. He held that it is impertinent to pray to God to change things. Instead, we cannot change the world, but we must change ourselves. So this we cannot agree to, but at the same time, if we are corrupt as human beings and original sin makes us all equally lost, then what is the soundness in the argument that you must rely on our heart over our head? This seems to be a bit of a false dilemma as well. And since this is a sermon, I thought I should quote a Bible verse. This is sort of the antithesis of what I did last week, sorry. In 1 Corinthians 2:14, I just thought this was a very fitting passage. The person without the Spirit does not accept things that come from the Spirit of God, but considers them foolishness and cannot understand them because they are discerned only through the Spirit. That is to say, they are discerned through the Spirit, neither through the heart or the head alone. In studying these men, I kind of thought, what could be worse than thinking you're enlightened when you are, in fact, sort of blinded by your own way of thinking? I found it interesting how little they relied on the Bible to form their views. I suppose this was their rejecting premodernism and authority, right? A couple paragraphs I'd like to read out of Being Human, which is addresses a lot of the things that I've talked about here. I actually only used one page out of it, but I thought it was a fantastic quote. Skepticism, however, was not the only child of the Enlightenment, nor were rational doubts the only problems with which evangelicals had to deal. Reaction set in, and reason was challenged even among those who made no claims to religious faith. The virtues and achievements of the mind began to be questioned. Some were dismayed at the inability of enlightened humanity to bring about peace and goodwill. Many despaired of meaning within an impersonal universe. Hence we have postmodernism. Hence reason was simultaneously exalted and disparaged. Some said the Bible was untrue because it conflicted with the assured results of science. Others said that religious truth, and consequently the truth of the Bible, had nothing to do with scientific or historical accuracy. So the rationalist derided the idea that the Bible was both philosophically and scientifically true. At the same time, those that maintained that religion was for the heart only, that the mind was inappropriate for understanding truth, criticize the evangelicals for holding tenaciously to the scientific, philosophic truth in the Bible. During the past 100 years, then, evangelicals have felt threatened from both sides, and on neither side has the struggle been easy. There is not one Goliath, but two to fight. One can understand why Christians have trembled and become disheartened. For these two attitudes, which are opposed to the historic Christian position, constitute the overwhelming consensus in the West today. So as I said, if you haven't read being human, I would encourage you to. It does an adept job of explaining what it means for mankind to be complete spiritual beings with both a heart and a mind, and one that doesn't have to be sacrificed at the expense of the other. It's also worth pointing out, certainly, that Jesus was the consummate example. I mean, you can see everything that he does, and they thought, you know, just even the phrase, you know, the silly phrase, he was a great moral teacher. Even if you believe that, that contains both of those ideas completely. He was moral, and he was a teacher. But from what we see, and I'm not saying that is the case, we see that he is 100%, just like his humanity and his divinity, he is 100% head and he's 100% heart. He dealt so well with trick questions the Pharisees and teachers of the law tried to confuse him with, and he trained them and taught them in a profound way because he himself was trained and he loved God's law. He didn't go in there and wing it, but he was also, you know, just the most humble of servants to the most lowly because, you know, he really loved them. And he loves us. God promises he can and will respond to those who seek him, whether it's by reading books or by simply reaching out to him with a sincere heart. But I think what we do, especially when it comes to philosophies in the Bible, is we tend to pick and choose what we want to see. I thought I would close with this quote, because it's not the whole quote. So this was, again, from Blaise Pascal. He says, the heart has its reasons, which reason knows nothing of. We know the truth not only by reason, but by the heart. I had at one point planned on giving a sermon instead on something that I would have called the fullness of the gospel, where I wanted to move from focusing on solely the intellectual aspect of the truth of Christianity to include the life of the Holy Spirit and what that might look like when we're talking about something that's a little bit less quantifiable. And while Descartes and Pascal were talking about ways to find God, you know, by the head or by the heart, maybe the next question could be, is living out the Christian life a matter of the head or the heart? And I think Tim's going to take that sermon. Is that right? Where's Tim? I'm just kidding. All right. Steve, you're going to close us?